Issues debate is not only affecting the election, it's shaping the progressive and conservative movements. Hear different perspectives on that topic when I'm joined at the roundtable by Republican strategist Amy Holmes and L'Opinion political editor Pilar Marrero. Then, Congressman John Murtha, one of the most powerful men in Washington, joins us to discuss the upcoming debate on President Bush's war funding request. You'll also find out what he thinks when he hears the words cut and run. And is youth activism temporary or is it here to stay? Find out when we speak with an activist about the issues driving young people to the polls and what will keep them engaged beyond November. I'm Melody Barnes, and join me to discuss these issues and more on The Progressive Beat, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And now two insightful political watchers will join us at the roundtable. Pilar Marrero, the award-winning senior political writer from L'Opinion, America's leading Spanish-language daily newspaper, and Amy Holmes, a Republican strategist who we see frequently on CNN. Welcome, Pilar and Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being at the roundtable. This is an important election, and the person elected president will find big problems on his or her desk on January 2009. But recently, some commentators have argued that not enough attention is being placed on the big issues, healthcare, global warming, for example. Is that a fair criticism? And if so, who's to blame? Amy?
I don't think that's entirely fair. I think that it is the natural outgrowth of the Democratic primary contest, where you have two candidates who were not very far apart on the issues. So as much as the media has been focusing on the Barack versus Hillary smackdown and personality issues that have been driving it in different demographics, and we haven't really gotten into the substance of it, I think come September, you'll start seeing some real policy debates.
That was Amy Holmes, who's a Republican strategist. Pilar Marrero, what do you think?
I think it is a fair criticism. I think that there are lots of things happening right now, and people are feeling a lot of pain. I work for a Spanish language newspaper, and we have obviously a Latino constituency, and we get letters. I get letters from people saying we want the candidates to talk about our problems. We are hurting. And but at the same time, we political observers and journalists, we are so into this fight for the nomination.
It's
so interesting
about.
Because, you know, before we used to complain, oh, there's no competition. You know, there's always this favorite guy and he always wins. And, you know, back when we had Gore and Kerry and all that. So, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's a lot of fun for us, for political journalists. But on the other hand, people are starting to feel like they are a little bit left out. And at the same time, they are very interested. I mean, they are fascinated by it, and they are registering to vote. I think we should probably move more to the issues after this Democratic fight is over.
Well, Pilar, picking up on what you said, what are the issues people are writing you? What are the issues they're writing you about? What do they want to hear more about?
It's fair to say we live in somewhat of a parallel universe, because a lot of Latinos get their news from ethnic media. A lot of people in the ethnic communities get their news from ethnic media. And we are seeing a lot of pain, economic pain, a lot of problems with the healthcare and the educational system. We are seeing immigration rates in communities where people are really getting scared. Just yesterday, we had an issue back in Northern California, in Berkeley and Oakland. They were doing some kind of operation. ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, were parking their vans near a school, and there was total panic in a couple of schools over there.
So they want to hear the candidates talking about those kinds of issues and
exactly
what they're going to do about them.
Exactly.
Well, Amy Holmes, I have this question for you. Do you believe then, if people are focused on the Democratic side, because there isn't a decision quite yet, is Senator McCain getting a free ride on those issues? He's out talking about judges, taking people back to his high school gym, but he's not necessarily giving people a good idea about the issues that he's going to focus on and how he's going to focus on them. Is he getting a free ride right now?
Well, I think he's giving a good idea about where he stands on the issues, but the media hasn't been telling the public too much about it because they've been focused on the horse race. If you go to John McCain's website, you'll see that he has, you know, his bullet plans for health care, for economic stimulus, for national security, for the war in Iraq. But I think this time has actually been helpful to John McCain to not be so much in the spotlight because it's given him a chance to really reach out to that conservative base that he needed to get to coalesce around his candidacy so he can give a speech on judicial nominations, which is a serious issue. The next president might be choosing two Supreme Court justices.
And I agree with you. I actually worked on the Judiciary Committee, so I completely agree with you that those are important. But in that speech, was he also sending a signal, kind of speaking in a language or at a level that conservatives could hear but people others couldn't pick up on, and sending a signal about social conservative issues, what he would do around abortion and other issues that this conservative base cares about?
Well, since you worked on the Judiciary Committee, you know that sort of similar issues were raised about the nomination of Judge Alito and so forth. That, yes, there is the wing of the Republican Party that is the values wing of the party, and that that does speak to their issues. But there's also the part of the Republican Party that's more libertarian-leaning, saying we should have someone who is strictly following the Constitution, not trying to make new law. That's also a legitimate way of looking at it. But I think that John McCain, yes, he was speaking to both groups, but I think generally the American public, he's going to be making the same pitch he did during the Republican primary when they were on the stage debating, and they'll get to hear what John McCain thinks about it.
Well, first of all, I want to remind people that you're listening to The Progressive Beat, and we're talking to Amy Holmes, a Republican strategist, and Pilar Marrero of La Opinión. And Pilar, I want to ask you this question. We were talking about that ideological split, the progressives and the conservatives. And this election happens, is taking place against that backdrop of the rebuilding of the progressive movement. People have been concerned about that for years. People have talked about the strength, Amy, of the conservative movement. What will this election tell us about which movement actually has grown stronger, which movement is attracting more people to its base? Pilar?
I think America will see a change in the characteristics of the voting population. It's already seeing it. It has been a very diverse country with a very non-diverse voting population so far. And in California and in other states, we've already seen some progress in the Latino vote and in other ethnic votes. I think I don't know about progressive or conservative. I don't think people think about issues in that way. Mm-hmm. I think they think about what they care about. And the general election will be decided by the center of the voting population, not by the progressives or the conservatives. But I do think it is a little bit of a return back to more of a progressive United States of America.
So maybe a little bit more progressive leaning. Amy, what do you think?
I think that the voters look at what are their values and what makes common sense. Now, is Barack Obama going to be able to say that his agenda is common sense and it appeals to the middle, as Pilar is saying, the middle's values? Or will John McCain be able to make that pitch? And I think, you know, once we see where the voters land, you can see which was stronger. I think what's also interesting about each of these candidates, and I'm, of course, assuming that Barack Obama gets the nomination, is that both of them are pitching very hard to the center. John McCain, he won the Republican primary so basically for the most part on the strength of moderate and independent voters.
So
we also see Barack Obama and has done better in open primaries where he can appeal to independent voters. And his pitch is very much there's no red state America. There's no blue state America. We're all one America. So it's going to be interesting, sort of like, you know,
you're
the
right
fight for the middle.
You're absolutely right. Well, we're all going to have to wait and see. I want to thank Amy Holmes and Pilar Marrero for being with me on The Progressive Beat, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund. And now I'm pleased to welcome Congressman John Murtha to the Progressive Beat. Congressman Murtha is an opponent of the war who really knows what it means to go to war. He's a former Marine and combat veteran of Vietnam. Congressman Murtha is also the chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee and has served the 12th Congressional District of Pennsylvania for 34 years. Welcome, Congressman Murtha.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about the economic cost of this war. Over 5 years ago, in the days leading up to the war, the president's economic advisor told the president that the war could cost about $200 billion. And Defense Secretary Rumsfeld said that that was, quote, baloney. And in fact, he estimated the cost at about $50 to $60 billion. And there was a lot of happy talk about how the Iraqi assets would actually fund the war. Congressman Murtha, where do things stand today?
Well, for the first place, it's so unfortunate because the administration, which had popularity worldwide at one point after 9/11, has let that deteriorate because of the excess untruthfulness that we've heard from them. They've talked about it cost $50 million. I remember coming before the committee saying that very thing. Now, here's the committee that funds the war, and they came before the committee and said it'd be $50 billion. They came for the war, said they'll throw flowers at us when we go into Iraq.
I remember that, exactly.
They talked about the infrastructure would be rebuilt immediately, and they'd be able to pay for the war themselves. I called for Secretary Wolfowitz's resignation because I felt he was the architect of the war. He said he had nothing to do with it. Nobody takes responsibility for these statements. I remember when Secretary Rumsfeld a year later came in, they said it was $1 billion. I said, well, it looks like to me it's getting to be close to $2 billion a month. Oh, no, he said, that's not going to happen. That's a spike. So they continually downplayed the cost. Now, what's it costing at home? Dave Obey and I introduced legislation that says there should be a surtax. We paid for the Vietnam War for 20 years because he didn't pay for it during the time that the war was on. So we introduced a surtax. Of course, that didn't pass. It didn't go anyplace. But we're trying to point out people have to pay. Now, what are they paying? They're paying now with high gasoline prices.
Right.
They're paying with food prices. They're paying with emotional strain of the war. And, of course, the families, a very small population of the United States, is paying a terrible physical and emotional strain. So we're paying a heavy price for this war, and they exaggerated the cost of it in the first place because they didn't pay any attention. They didn't listen. They didn't ask for help from the international community. They bowled ahead thinking we could win militarily. We cannot win this war militarily, and unfortunately, keep saying we can.
And Congressman Murth, I want to pick up on one of the points that you were making. You said they came to us, to the committee that was funding the war. You all should have been partners in this conversation, and they provided estimates that were not factual, that were not correct. Do you think that they got it wrong, or do you think that in the hurry to go to war that they were putting information in front of you, in front of your committee, that just wasn't accurate and they knew it at the time?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. They were so intent on going to war that they're going to exaggerate and diminish the cost to the American public, because they knew if they understood the cost. For instance, we've had over 4,000 casualties now.
Mm-hmm.
They felt like it'd be a very limited war and there'd be no casualties. Since the president said mission accomplished, 3,900 of those casualties have come to the troops. And we've had 30,000 people wounded or injured in this war. So they exaggerated in the extreme to make people think this is going to be easy. And people look back at the 91 war,
right,
and they thought it was the same thing. So many people who voted for it thought, well, this president will get worldwide involvement. He'll get international help.
Right. He'll follow his father's lead, and not from 91.
As a matter of fact, many of his father's intimate helpers, people that worked for him, were against it. Brent Scowcroft, who was his national security advisor,
right,
his people called me and said, look, we think you ought to talk this president out of going to war. I remember sitting there on the floor. In the 91 war, I went all out because I felt like it was an invasion in Kuwait that intimidated the rest of the world, and we'd have a real problem.
Right. We had to go in at that time.
We had to go in. Now, I kept saying to myself, there's so much uncertainty about this intelligence. But I thought, well, we'll give the president an opportunity. Let him negotiate. Let him have a stick that shows that we could go to war with Saddam Hussein.
But he abused that trust, I think.
He abused the trust, and it even goes farther than that. Then they exaggerated, and then they distorted the information that we got. They treat Congress as if it's a distraction. They don't want anything to do with Congress. They continue to do that today. They continue to issue veto threats. They continue to treat Congress like it's somebody that doesn't want to help. We want to help get this thing over with, and they continually say we're going to continue this war no matter what Congress does, and we're in a very difficult position where if you cut off the funding for the troops in the field, it would be a disaster for us. So we're trying to work it out so we force them to start a timetable which will force the Iraqis to take over this war themselves.
And I want to talk about more of what's going on right now. First, I want to remind people that you're listening to The Progressive Beat, and I'm here with Congressman John Murtha, who's the chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Mr. Chairman, before you right now is a request from the administration for additional funding for the war. If that's granted, that means that the cost of the Iraqi war will equate to about $750 billion. How far do you think Congress will go with funding this war? And can you tell us a little bit about what you think for the future?
Yeah, well, the House, as you know, has passed a number of requirements that we felt the administration should adhere to. No torture, no permanent bases, a timetable to get out of Iraq, and also at the same time we passed money, which allowed the troops to continue. It would be, I think, a mistake if we were just to cut off the money because even if we said, all right, you do it in some sort of a timetable, we could pass it in the House. They would never pass in the Senate.
Right. But so the American people really struggle with that.
The American people want us out of there.
Absolutely.
They know the cost. They know the price. They understand how difficult it is for their family, and especially the families of the people that are serving over there. They've been deployed 3 and 4 times.
Right.
They've broken every guideline. As I said 2 years ago, they can't sustain this war with the number of people they have without breaking every guideline. Instead of letting them stay at home 2 years, they let them stay at home only 1 year. And then they deploy for 15 months instead of a year.
And when they come back, they come back to the awful conditions at Fort Bragg.
I tell you, I called Secretary of Army and I told him how distressed I was that they would allow something like this to happen. He said, well, they came home 2 weeks early. I said, there's no excuse for this. This is unacceptable. Same thing happened to Walter Reed.
Absolutely.
And of course, then you have incidents where we're using overwhelming force and we're not winning the hearts and minds of the people. You can't win a war like this without winning the hearts and minds of the people. So the Congress is going to struggle trying to make sure the troops have what they need, and at the same time trying to restrict the president from his this war, which is so devastating to our economy, to the people at home, and to our reputation worldwide.
Well, Congressman, as we wrap up, I want to ask you this question, because people hear the kinds of comments, the truth that you're speaking, and we've heard it also from members of the military, General Cody and others recently. But during the debate, the pushback on this is, oh, you want to cut and run. You're waving the white flag of surrender, whether we're talking about strategy or the cost. As we wrap up, tell us, how do you respond to that?
Well, I remember Beirut, where President Reagan said, after 241 Marines were killed, we're never going to leave there. If we leave there, it'll be a disaster to the American future operations. Well, 4 months later, he left Beirut. I remember in Somalia, when I advised the president not to go into Somalia, President Bush won. I said, if you go in there, you won't be able to get out. And he said, I'll have him out by Inauguration Day. Well, it was 400 days later, almost a year, over a year later, that they got him out. So I'm saying we have to do what's best for our national security. We've done everything we could in Iraq. The Iraqis have to take over this. And I think you're going to see the Iraqis are not going to ask for an extension of the UN resolution. I think the Iraqis are going to demand that they make the decision, and that will start the redeployment of our American forces back to the United States.
Well, thank you, Congressman Murtha. It's been a pleasure to have you on the Progressive Beat, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
Nice to be here, Molly.
I was just speaking with Congressman Murtha about the high cost of the war in Iraq, but the price being paid by the men and women in the military and their families is almost unimaginable. Last week, Republican Senator Chuck Hagel drove the point home.
At a time when we're asking less than 1% of our population to bear all the burden, make all the sacrifices, do all the fighting, do all the dying, and the rest of us get tax cuts, we think we're doing our part by putting a bumper sticker on the car, support our troops. And of course, the coup de grace is you have to have a flag in your lapel if you're a real American.
Senator Hagel is right, but not everyone gets it. The Pentagon and some members of Congress are trying to prevent a 21st century bipartisan GI Bill from becoming law. They're saying that giving 2 years of military service isn't enough of a, quote, commitment to qualify for expanded benefits. A Pentagon spokesman said,
well, we have no issue with the fact that Senator Webb wishes to, you know, provide a more generous education benefit to troops. But we are certainly concerned that this would be eligible to them after only 2 years of service. We think pegging it to a longer period of service, the number we have in mind at this point is 6 years of service. That the longer you stay in, the sweeter the benefits are to you. 6 years would show a commitment to service.
Unbelievable. I say, what about fewer bumper stickers, less rhetoric, and more real support for our troops? For more information on this issue, go to www.progressreport.org. Now let's turn our attention to one of the hottest topics of the campaign season, youth activism. We're joined by Erica Williams, Issue Campaigns Manager for Campus Progress, a project of the Center for American Progress Action Fund, to learn more about what's making younger voters tick. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you for having me, Melody.
For months, people have expressed shock and awe at the numbers at which young people are going to the polls. Is this out of the blue? Is this a surprise for you?
No, it's not. We've been expecting it for quite some time now. I think there are a lot of different factors that are impacting the rise in the youth vote. But I would say that the predominant factor is the fact that since 2004, a lot of nonpartisan organizations, both on the progressive and conservative side, have made a very concerted effort to organize and engage young people in preparation for this election and beyond. So right now, we're just seeing the impact of all of that work.
And beyond the act, well, I guess it's the organizing and the activism that's been taking place for several years, what are the issues that are driving young people to the polls?
I think that's a funny question because so often we talk about young people as if they're kind of this separate group that don't have some of the same issues and concerns. Young people have the same issues and concerns as perhaps the next generation, but it's a matter of how those issues impact young people. So having said that, I think just like the rest of the country, the economy is very important to young Americans, particularly as it relates to college affordability, economic mobility. We just recently released a report here at the Center for American Progress that said that our generation, while much more progressive on economic issues, is actually the first generation that will be worse off economically than our parents' generation.
And didn't Bob Herbert write, I saw a piece earlier today, he had a piece in the New York Times making that very point.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So that's something that I think a lot of young people are starting to feel the crunch from, again, maybe in a different way. Perhaps it's not the housing crisis or the credit crunch, but it is college affordability, decrease in wages. We're seeing those things hit us pretty hard.
And one thing I found interesting, and again, Bob Herbert focused attention on this, is the fact that young people want the government to make investments in those areas. And I think that's interesting because so many young people, you know, we're talking about 18 to 30 years old, have grown up in an era where government has been bad. It's been a demon. It's been the thing that you want to make small and, as one conservative said, drown in a bathtub. But they seem to have the opposite opinion.
It's the opposite opinion in the sense that I think we agree that government has been bad, but we believe that it can be changed. We believe that it is for a higher purpose and that it should be involved in kind of supporting and helping our generation, because we feel that it did that for our parents' generation from, you know, the GI Bill on, and we feel like we deserve that as well right now.
And do you think that desire to change government, change the way things are being done, is what will keep young people engaged and active beyond the November election?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a matter of that. I think it's accountability. If we can continue to be engaged and hold our elected officials accountable for the promises that they've made thus far, I think the next step is also about building relationships as we begin to engage around, you know, election 08. It's much broader than that. It's about the issues. It's about seeing people in our communities and actually developing one-on-one relationships so that not only can we hold our elected officials accountable, but we ourselves can be held accountable for our civic engagement.
So will we see that today when young people are voting in West Virginia and Nebraska?
We absolutely will. We've been talking with young people on the ground. I'm very optimistic about it.
Right. And you've been talking to a lot of people. That's part of your job.
Absolutely. We've been talking to young people on the ground, students at some of the universities in those states, and we found that they have for months been engaged in the election, both kind of in an issue oriented aspect in terms of going and talking about voting for candidates that support certain issues, particularly in West Virginia, where it's a coal state. We've been seeing a lot of increase in climate issues, which is the number one issue for young people as well.
Right, right, exactly. And you expressed optimism about what happens next. And there's been so many reports about young people being apathetic. But your experience seems to say something quite different about that. If there isn't progress made on the issues that young people care about, how do you think they'll respond?
I mean, I'm sure there'll be a sense of disappointment, absolutely, but young people are not apathetic in any way, shape, or form. I think the activism of our generation might look a bit different than that of our parents' generation. For example, we're doing more online activism and organizing. We're blogging. We're talking about the issues a bit more and kind of expanding the dialogue. We are working in droves for nonprofits and really finding that if we can't count on government to help and impact these issues that we care about, then we'll go out and do it ourselves. So I think we might see a different avenue for that energy and work, but it's not going to disappear.
Well, Erica, I hope you're right. This has been very exciting thus far. We have a lot more to look forward to in the coming months. And thank you, Erica Williams, for being on the Progressive Beat with Melody Barnes.
Thank you, Melody.
What candidate received 12% of the vote in last week's North Carolina primary? Mike Huckabee. I know. You're thinking, didn't he drop out of the race? Well, that may be true, but 23% of those voting in North Carolina's Republican primary supported Huckabee, Congressman Ron Paul, or, quote, no preference. 1% of Democrats supported no preference. The same thing happened in Indiana, with Huckabee, Paul, and Mitt Romney collectively getting 23% of the Republican vote. While pundits are wondering if Clinton supporters will vote for Obama and vice versa, at least in some parts of the country, almost a quarter of those voting for Republicans aren't supporting John McCain. Keep an eye on those numbers going forward. Do they spell trouble for McCain or foreshadow the kind of vice presidential candidate he needs to round out the ticket? One more thing. If you find out who takes time out of their day to go to the polls and vote for, quote, no preference, please let us know. Well, what does next week's primary contest in Kentucky have in common with this week's contest in West Virginia? One word, coal. West Virginia and Kentucky are the country's two largest coal-producing states, and during the primaries and the general election, we should keep an eye on the substance and the politics. There's a great deal at stake, and the coal industry and the environmental community are battling it out. We'll take a look to determine who's got the upper hand. Join me next week to discuss that issue and much, much more on The Progressive Beat with Melody Barnes, broadcast from the Center for American Progress Action Fund.